Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When is the best time to take action? Is sooner always better than later? We revere speed in 21st century America. We want fast cars and faster computers, and we look askance at anybody who appears inclined to put things off. But as my guest today will tell us, a mounting body of evidence suggests our confidence in snap judgments isn't really leading us to the best possible decisions all the time. Frank Partnoy is professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego and a practicing corporate lawyer. He writes about what he's learned in his new book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Frank, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much.
So you call Malcolm Gladwell's Blink a brilliant and accessible book, but in terms of takeaway messages, it sounds like maybe we all read it too fast.
Maybe that's right. The last third of Blink was about the dangers of snap decision-making, the police shooting of Amadou Diallo in the Bronx, and the snap reactions of music auditioners based on gender. But either people didn't make it to the last part, or we just interpreted it as being a book about the good parts of snap decisions. And the part of it was the language in the first half of the book, which I loved. I thought it was a great book, but it talked about this sort of magic interval of 2 seconds and how much information we can process in 2 seconds. And although it's true, we do very well in certain ways in 2 seconds, often we're much better off taking a lot longer than 2 seconds.
Yeah, and it seems like the experts, even those who utilize that, recognize that if they have more time, they're even better off.
That's right. And in fact, even the studies that are cited in Blink talk about how experts are better off having more time. John Gottman, the famous psychologist who is able to tell whether people will stay together just based on watching brief snippets of videos of them interacting.
Yeah.
Even the initial studies, he took several minutes, up to 15 minutes. And when he asks people now to come to him to assess their relationships, he asks them to come to his private island for 2 days, not for 2 seconds. So 2 seconds is a nice mantra for some of our snap reactions, but actually for some snap reactions we're much faster than that. For race and gender, sexual orientation, to the extent we can detect this, the sorts of things, if the idea of being able to tell someone's sexual orientation by looking at their face, we're not hugely good at it, but to the extent we're good at it in 100 milliseconds, not 2 seconds.
Well, here you write about this really interesting study where physicians were studied to see whether or not unconscious racial bias could play into their decision making.
Yes. Yeah, so we don't think of doctors as being racist generally, but there are numerous studies that show that doctors have what are called implicit racial preferences, that they systematically undertreat black patients. It's just a fact that studies have established this. And so one group of scientists was studying a group of doctors trying to assess this again. They gave doctors a photo of a patient. Half of the doctors saw a white person, half the doctors saw a black person. And in fact, the doctors followed these other studies and systematically undertreated the black patient. But what one of the interesting things they found in the study was that there have been so many of these studies now that sometimes doctors figure out what's up.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of these doctors, one of in four of them, figured out that they were testing their racial biases. And so for those doctors, they paused and took a moment and thought about the fact that they might have a racial bias. And for those doctors, there was no effect based on race. They didn't systematically undertreat the black patients. It's really interesting that once race was an issue for the doctors, once they explicitly thought about it, it actually no longer was an issue in their treatment decisions.
Yeah, and the brilliant thing about that is that we can all do that. We can all stop ourselves and say, wait, am I making this hiring decision or whatever based on race?
That's exactly right. And we all have these biases. We're not consciously aware of them, but we all have them. And we have a kind of magic antidote, which is just taking a deep breath, staring off into the distance, taking a few minutes. And the studies show that that will help to counteract our biases.
So you talked about the decisions, the assessments that we make in milliseconds. And I found it fascinating, Frank, that the first people you identify as benefiting from taking the maximum time possible to make decisions are athletes, for whom we normally assume speed is a primary advantage.
That's right. And these are the last people we would think of as being slow. I mean, we're always taught that these athletes are better because they're fast. And in super fast sports, like returning a tennis serve or hitting a major league baseball pitch, it's so fast, it's not even conscious. It's less than 500 milliseconds that athletes have to react. But one of the things that studies have shown is that what makes athletes better, what distinguishes a professional from an amateur, is a delay of just about 50 milliseconds. That basically what the professional athletes are doing is getting really good at their stroke, at returning a serve or hitting a baseball, getting so fast at that that they can delay until the last possible second. Coaches call it ball identification. And you often hear about players saying they want to wait until the last possible millisecond to hit the ball. And what it does is it frees up extra time for them to process information about the speed, flight, and trajectory of the ball to get extra data. And then they can process this data. This is all, again, super fast, pre-conscious. They're not thinking at all. But that's their advantage. And I think it's a nice rubric for all of us in our decisions to think about, that we can kind of follow this two-step process of first figuring out the maximum amount of time that we have. For a baseball player, it's 500 milliseconds, and then waiting as long as we possibly can. Second, delaying, or even we could call it procrastinating, waiting until the last possible moment.
These days we view procrastination as a shortcoming, if not an outright character flaw, but it has not always been that way. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of procrastination?
Procrastination used to be regarded as a great thing. It was a source of wisdom. It was an indication of leadership. The Greeks and the Romans valued procrastinators, people who would just sit back and think and strategize about the future. And really that all started to change in the 18th century with the Puritan work ethic, and Jonathan Edwards wrote a sermon that he gave fighting against procrastination. And the thinking started to change during the Industrial Revolution, but really the major guilt that we all feel about procrastinating started in the 1970s, when a kind of anti-procrastination industry started to develop. There were business experts like Peter Drucker and David Allen telling us first things first and get things done, and we started to feel really bad about procrastinating, even as we admitted doing it more and more. And one of the things about procrastination is it's just a part of the human condition. We always have an infinite number of things that we could be doing, so we're always going to be procrastinating. We're going to be needlessly putting off things that we could get done today. And we've been made to feel progressively bad about that, but really it's just a part of being human. And the question is not so much, are you procrastinating? All of us are procrastinating. The question is, are you procrastinating the right things? Are you delaying the things you should be delaying and getting some things done?
So the fact that I still haven't organized my vacation photos is okay because I'm sitting here at work.
Exactly right. So we shouldn't make you feel guilty about that. Maybe eventually you'll get around to it, right? But the question is about prioritization, right? So you have things that are more pressing that you need to do now, and then you have other things that you put off. And some people have a real issue with chronic procrastination, that they need to feel that there's something that they're procrastinating, or they just won't feel whole. And some people feel incredibly bad about those photos hanging over their head. And one of the things I wanted to do in Wait is just to show people that the research shows that what you're doing, if you're procrastinating some things, is not necessarily such a bad thing.
And you can actually make a list of things that you know are okay to procrastinate on indefinitely and therefore move along with the things that matter.
Well, this is a great one. There's a psychologist at Stanford called John Perry, and what he recommends that people do is something he calls structured procrastination. So pick out a couple of things that you know you'll put off. You know you will procrastinate. So for me, I'd like to write the great American novel, or I've got a dirty closet that's just not going to get cleaned up. And I make a list of the things that I need to do, and the top tasks on the list are those. They're the ones I'm going to procrastinate. And so I have kind of built in what I'm going to procrastinate. And then further down on the list are the things I actually need to do, you know, grade exams or prepare to teach my students or various tasks around the house. And so I'll get all of that done, but I'll still kind of satisfy this urge that we all have to at least feel like we're procrastinating something. So I'll sort of fill up my procrastination bucket with things I'm not going to do anyway.
Well, it occurred to me reading your bio that you must be kind of brilliant at time management. You are a practicing attorney. You are teaching. You are writing. Talk about how all of this research that you did found its way back into your actual life?
Well, one of the things I've learned over the last 3 years is that it's really important to manage delay, and that I shouldn't feel bad about procrastinating as long as I'm getting things done. That there's a distinction between passive, what psychologists call passive procrastination, which is just being lazy, lying around on the sofa, mm-hmm. which I like to do too and do some of. There's a distinction between that kind of passive procrastination and active procrastination, where you're prioritizing, where you're deciding, okay, I really need to work on this right now. And one of the things that I've learned over the last 3 years of research and from writing Wait is there are certain things I just don't need to do right now, that there's this crush of technology, of email and social media and 24-hour news, and that sometimes when I get an email and somebody's asking me to do something, I might respond right away and tell them, okay, I got it, but put it in my calendar as something that will be done in a week. Hmm. Or that I like to look at Twitter and Facebook and follow 24-hour news, but sometimes I'll just take a break and carve out an hour or two of strategy time or just alone time, reading time. But that it takes a conscious effort, that we really are all hardwired to succumb to this technology, and that we have to take a conscious pause, that we have to force ourselves to get away from it. And I've been, you know, it's an uphill battle given how fast our world is now, but one of the things that I've taken away just concretely is to engage that battle and to just every day consciously say, okay, I'm going to take my time.
I wonder if some of our guilt over procrastination comes from the fact that other people put their lists in different order. So if you have a good friend who does write the great American novel and it's on your list far down, but you didn't get to it, somehow you feel like you haven't done the right thing.
Oh, I think that's a great point, right? And we're all very competitive, especially with our peers and our friends. And so if someone else has accomplished something, you know, I hate going to somebody's house that's immaculate. That, you know, you look at, they'll even show you their closets right. That are completely clean and organized, and we feel bad about that, right? But again, the thing to keep in mind is taking a step back is that part of human nature is that we'll just have too many things to do. And so the question is, are we prioritizing? And can you learn from someone you are insanely jealous of? Maybe I'm making the wrong choices. Maybe I've got the wrong priorities and I shouldn't be spending time at work or with my family. But if someone is working on a cure for cancer and they have a messy closet, does it really make sense for them to feel terribly guilty about procrastinating if what they're doing has an important social value?
How did we begin to measure our work days according to hours rather than output?
Yeah, it's a really interesting problem. So we started to move away from something called event time to something called clock time. The idea of event time was you have breakfast and start working when the sun comes up. You respond to an event, and you work until the sun goes down. And you don't worry about the clock or hourly changes. And it started in the Industrial Revolution, but over time we've become much, much more focused on the clock. Right now, about 58% of workers in the American economy are paid by the hour or are charged out by the hour. And being on clock time has a really pernicious effect on our lives. Studies show that people who are billed out by the hour start to think about their leisure time as costing them money. Hmm. There's a study of hourly wages where one group was paid $9 per hour. They were billed out at $9 per hour, and the other was billed out at $90 per hour. And the people who were billed out at $90 per hour started to feel more impatient. They had a much more difficult time. You know, if you think about it, going to the kids' soccer game is going to cost you hundreds of dollars. We don't like making those trade-offs, and so people who are billed out by the hour unfortunately have to suffer through that.
Frank Partnoy is with us. His new book is called Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 after the break.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frank Partnoy. He's professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego and a practicing corporate lawyer. His new book is called Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. If you'd like to join us with a question or weigh in on the topic, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Frank, it shouldn't be surprising maybe that this is a double-edged problem. Not only do we like to make decisions as fast as possible, we also have an increasingly difficult time waiting for anything we happen to want.
Yes, that's right. And we're impatient, right? We're hardwired after our ancestors spent thousands of years out on the savannah to have a fight-or-flight response. And given the crush of technology, our fight-or-flight response is triggered by all of this stimulus in our environment, and it often hurts us. It speeds us up in all kinds of unanticipated ways. For example, people encounter fast food logos all the time, and we're consciously aware of it. But even when we're unconsciously aware of something like a fast food logo, we are dramatically affected by it. So there was a study that was done where one group didn't see anything on a computer screen, and the other group had a fast food logo flashed, just a few milliseconds of a fast food logo flashed, and guess how it impacted them? Just seeing, not even realizing that you've seen it. No one realized consciously that they had seen this thing, but just subliminally being flashed a McDonald's logo made people read 20% faster.
Wow.
It made them much more impatient. It made them have a hard time enjoying looking at beautiful photographs. It made them have a hard time enjoying a musical piece, which they thought was taking too long. And we're exposed to this sort of thing all of the time. And again, our hardwiring will react to it in ways that would have been good for us 100,000 years ago, but are not so good for us today.
What does our ability to sort of step back and relax about certain things have to do with, what's the relationship to our heart rate?
The heart rate piece of this is fascinating. There's a guy called Stephen Porges who studies milliseconds-long changes in our heart rate, what he calls heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it's rather than just measuring our heart rate, particularly in infants, what he's doing is measuring how quickly the heart can accelerate or decelerate. So, for example, if you have 2 9-month-olds and they both have hearts that beat on average 100 beats a minute, one might not be able to accelerate and decelerate very much. It might the heart might vary in a range of 90 to 100, and then the other might have a wider range of, say, 80 to 120. And what he's found is that having that wider range of heart rate variability is associated with better mental health, better emotional health, that people who have all kinds of mental disorders are more likely to have a less variable heart rate. And some of this is speculative, but studies have suggested that heart rate variability plays a role in anything ranging from asthma to autism to borderline personality disorder, that part of our ability to delay gratification is based on having a variable heart rate, being able to kind of accelerate and brake quickly. You can imagine driving a car on a dangerous road. Well, if you're driving a high-performance car that can speed up and slow down very quickly, you'd feel safer. Hmm. And what Porges says is that a similar thing is true about our emotional lives, that if we have the ability to speed up our heart rate and slow it down quite a bit, that will make our lives a safer ride.
What's remarkable about that is that, in a way, it's counterintuitive. One would think that the person whose heart rate doesn't change very often would be sort of more steady emotionally.
It's very much counterintuitive. I thought it was crazy, honestly, when I first read about it. But after reading all of the literature, it's confirmed again and again that what matters more is having a variable heart rate. I'll just give you one example. It matters even for very young children. There's a study done of 9-month-olds. And so they were brought in, and there were standard tests that were administered, the Bayley tests of infant development, where you give the toddlers some toys to play with. You test the reactions. There were surveys that the parents took about the toddler's behavior, the 9-month-old's behavior. And then in addition to that, they were hooked up with cardiotachometers that measured their heart rate variability. And then they were brought back in 3 years later at age 3, And the researchers tested which of these factors predicted their behavior. And they found that the Bayley Scales test, the standard tests of infant development that are used, didn't predict which infants would become better behaved or worse behaved, that their parents were wrong, that infants that behaved well at 9 months would behave horribly at 3 years and vice versa, but that the one thing that predicted behavior was heart rate variability, that a nine-month-old who has the ability to vary his or her heart rate, and again, this is just milliseconds. It's not something that you can detect or think about consciously, that those were the infants that were better behaved at 3 months. And studies show that it continues up until adulthood, that we are better off if we have highly variable heart rates. And it seems to me that someday we'll use heart rate variability as an indicator of mental health in the same way we use blood pressure and cholesterol as measures of our physical health.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone to Dave in Dallas. Hello, Dave.
Hi. Interesting show. Your guest had talked about the stresses of an hourly employee versus a salaried employee, and that's actually something I hadn't thought of, because as a salaried employee, I've always been sort of jealous of people who can punch out at 5 o'clock and then just be free to do whatever they wanted for the rest of the day or on their vacation. As a salaried employee, you're expected to work at night, you're expected to answer emails during your vacation. There's a lot of continual relentless work that is constantly intruding on your life, and I wanted your guest comments on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Dave. It's a very interesting point, and one of the problems that people who are paid by the hour have that you don't have is that you actually can go on a vacation. They if you're charging by the hour, if you're a contractor or you're just billing out by the hour, any vacation, any time off at all is coming, you think about as coming straight out of your pocket. And one of the problems with hourly pay is that people start to think about time off as the same as time on. So they feel this pressure to bill more and more and more. And the other perverse thing that happens is that, and it's true to some extent of salaried employees, but it's worse for hourly employees, is that as you start to make more money, this gets worse and worse. So as you make more money, you regard your time as more scarce. It seems like it's more valuable. So things that are more valuable are more scarce, right? Diamonds are scarce. They're valuable. If you're being billed out at a high rate, your time is more valuable. And so all of those events, the vacation starts to look like it's costing you not just the cost of the hotel and the airfare and the rides at Disneyland, but also the lost work. I was also surprised by the research, but it shows that for 58% of the workforce, that there are these negative effects that we can hopefully overcome either by changing the way we bill or by just becoming consciously aware of it, so that we block out and distinguish our leisure time, our personal lives, from our professional lives.
Let's go back to the importance and the value of delay in certain situations. You had an op-ed in the New York Times recently about the coverage of the Supreme Court decision upholding the Affordable Care Act. And in the race to be first, it turned out some very influential news organizations initially got it wrong.
That's right. Both CNN and Fox got it wrong. It's incredible. But given how quickly 24-hour news wants to react, we are often getting the wrong result repeatedly. And this was a dramatic instance where they actually called the result of the case 180 degrees opposite of what it was. But it happens in smaller ways as well, where we get a view of a topic that might be skewed or slightly off, and the view that comes in instantly, either through Twitter or through instant news through the web, is kind of the anchor. Economists call it path dependence, that we start off on a certain track, and it's a problem with us making snap reactions to news because they're not very informed. It's sort of like the tennis player or the baseball player who can wait longer for more information. We'd be better off being able to delay our snap reactions to news events until we're more fully informed, but it's really hard to do that. And it's incredible that we have the technology to tell us what the Supreme Court said within a few seconds. But I think we have to be really careful about how we interpret them again, think about what the right time frame is, and when there is an important news event, maybe take a step back and say, you know what, I'm going to wait a few days for a more news analysis to come out before I make my judgment about this.
It's funny because I first had notification that a decision had been made from this little iPhone app that I have from the New York Times. And initially I was frustrated because what I got was a message that said, there's been a decision, we need some time to read through it and give it some analysis before we report the result. Turns out that was brilliant, and it meant that I didn't get the wrong information initially.
That's right, and I think in journalism is a great example of how the crush of technology is speeding up decisions and reactions. And if you look at who's most likely to survive this kind of war of attrition in journalism, as with many businesses, it's likely to be the groups that are able to delay gratification, that are able to take a little bit of time and provide superior analysis and news coverage, which is what people want. And not just provide speed. So we like to have speed. I mean, we like to have quick information at our fingertips. But how necessary really is it to our daily lives that we have it instantaneously? What is, again, going back to these questions, what is the right amount of delay? What is the right time world to be living in? And we used to do just fine getting the news at the end of the day. And sometimes it's very helpful to have instant news if there's been an earthquake or a natural disaster, someone in our family needs to reach us with something that's happened that touches on our family. But most of the time, we're better off waiting a little bit. And so it sounds like that app is doing that and doing it very well.
So let's talk about money. Famously, there are people who have made careers out of day trading and out of instant financial transactions. What role, though, did those kinds of decisions have in the financial crisis that came to a head in this country 4 years ago?
I think a major role. I think one of the biggest problems on Wall Street, and I used to work on Wall Street. I worked at Morgan Stanley in their derivatives group. One of the biggest problems on Wall Street has been the snap reactions and the very, very fast pace of trading and decisions. 70% of trades now, stock trades, are high-frequency trades by computer algorithms. The market is changing daily, getting faster and faster. And going back to the financial crisis, there were a lot of snap decisions that were made by major sophisticated financial institutions about risk that turned out to be completely wrong. And I think a lot of it has to do with how people thought about decisions. One of the things that I found in my research was that Lehman Brothers, in fall of 2005, had created a decision-making course. They had taken 4 dozen of their top executives and brought them to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue, brought in a bunch of decision-making experts from Harvard and elsewhere. They had asked Malcolm Gladwell, who had just published Blink, this is fall of 2005, to come in and give the capstone lecture. They were very much a go-with-your-gut, 2 seconds kind of group. Joe Gregory, the president of Lehman Brothers, passed out copies of Blink on the trading floor at the firm, and they came and they took this course, which very much justified snap, go-with-your-gut decision-making, and then they marched quickly across Manhattan to their headquarters in Times Square and proceeded to make the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets. And I just thought, wow, they've got the whole course is wrong. Wall Street needs to take a different course and understand research, especially since Blink, that has shown that there are dangers associated with quick decisions, and that people in the financial services industry generally, really all of us, but especially people who work in finance, would be much better off and make better decisions taking longer. I mean, the quintessential long-term decision maker is Warren Buffett. He will take, and he's proud of this, he will take as long as he possibly can to make decisions. And he's not lazy. He's not lying around on the sofa. He's working around the clock. But when it comes to making an investment decision, he'll sit back and wait.
What about people who, based on the nature of their work, must make incredibly fast decisions? One of the things it turns out that these people have to do is prepare themselves to not have to make any decisions in a time of crisis.
That's exactly right. And these are people like firefighters or ER workers, people in the military. And one of the things they have to do is develop their intuition in advance, so that they won't have to make a decision when the time comes. And in fact, they do this. And one of the experts who studies decision-making, Gary Klein, when first asked to look at decision-making for the military, chose to look at firefighters. And one of the first questions he asked them was, well, how do you make decisions? And the reaction that he got was, well, what are you talking about? We don't make decisions. I mean, we arrive at a scene and we know based on our experience that this is the sort of fire that is a vertical fire, so we need to spray water down from the top, or it's already, the building's already gone too far, so we need to run a rescue operation instantly. but the interesting thing about even firefighters or ER workers is that if they can delay, even within their tight time frame, as much as they possibly can, that they're better off, that they get additional information out of even just a few extra seconds, and that sometimes when you think you're an expert, that's the most dangerous situation you can be in, that that experts are used to going with their snap decisions, but sometimes someone who thinks they're an expert is really an amateur. And so for example, there's one scene, one study of firefighters who had arrived at a scene where there was a fire burning out of control, and their gut reaction was, we've got to get in there and spray water right away, get close to the fire. But they sensed that something was wrong. They sensed that this was new, that they were novices, not experts. And there's a sort of wisdom associated with that. They just sat there and watched the fire burn for more than a day. And ultimately, they discovered that there was a gigantic pipe pumping fresh oil into the base of the fire, so that if they had gone in instantly, they all would have died. But they had enough perspective on their own expertise to know that they were amateurs, that they weren't experts at that time. And so they were able to wait and then shut off the pipe and the flowing oil, and then the fire burned out on its own. So one of the messages is to really know when you're an expert and when you're an amateur.
My guest this hour is Frank Partnoy. He's a professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego and a practicing corporate lawyer. We're speaking this hour about his new book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open now at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to join the conversation to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Frank Partnoy, who is professor of law and finance at the University of San Diego and author of the new book, Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we find Ken on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I have a little bit of a tidbit for Mr. Partnoy. I don't remember the source of where I read it or where I heard it, but I remember that somebody said, Napoleon said the reason he was so successful in his battles was that he did not go to a battlefield with a predetermined attack plan or tactics. He waited to get to the scene, survey the scene, and then determine what the best tactics were.
Thanks for your call.
Would you know that? Could you tell me the source or if that is true?
Yes, there are. I'm not sure I can give you a source right now, but there are. I talked to several military historians about this idea of delay tactics, and they cite Napoleon. They cite several other examples, and of course, there's the famous, you know, don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. This idea of strategic delay is prominent in military history. It's in Sun Tzu, The Art of War. And it's used now by military technicians. One of the most interesting, and I believe John Boyd talks about Napoleon, so if you're interested in finding out the details about that particular story, There's a lot of writing about John Boyd, who was a arguably one of the greatest jet fighter pilots in military history. And he writes about something very similar to what you've said, which is known as the OODA loop, for OODA. And it's almost exactly what you've just described Napoleon doing, just in a more modern context. The OODA stands for Observe, Orient, Decide, and Act. The idea is that you come to the scene, you observe, you watch. For Boyd, it was watching the fighter pilot who's making moves up in the air around him. You orient, just like you were saying with Napoleon or Boyd, sort of figure out where you fit into the situation. And then finally, you make your decision about how to act, and then you act. And then you do this in a kind of loop, that there's something called the OODA loop. And the idea is to get fast, but not get fast in order to necessarily be faster than your opponent, but to confuse your opponent, to get more information than your opponent. It's almost exactly the same thing, the idea of getting fast in order to go slow, getting fast in order to process more information. It's almost exactly the same as what baseball players and tennis players do. But yeah, thank you for that example. I've heard that from several people.
So we've talked a lot about the science of delay, Frank, but I want to get to the art of it, because you point out that some of the people we revere as the most talented performers are just masters of timing and of holding for just a beat at exactly the right time.
And you do it too, right? You have just a slight pause in your voice, which studies show that you're doing exactly the right thing as you ask questions and speak, that we're more persuasive and compelling if we have a little bit of delay.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that.
In our speech, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We wait a little while. Studies show 4 or 5 times a minute is optimal. But yeah, I looked at actors and comedians. I talked to the great acting coach Walker Clark about this notion that great actors don't panic and don't rush. They take their time delaying speech. And also comedians, the idea of the pregnant pause, of the extended beat, where you apply this same kind of two-step process. First, figure out what time world you're living in, what's the most amount of time you can take, the greatest delay. In this case, it's the delay before a punchline.
Yeah.
And then second, wait until the last possible moment. And there was the most amazing example I've seen of this was of Jon Stewart last year reacting to comments that Sarah Palin made in response to U.S. Military activities after the Arab Spring in Libya. And there was a question about whether what the authority was for our activity. And so Sarah Palin said, I'm not sure what word to use this. Are we at war? Is there some other word? What should I call it? And then she said, is it a skirmish? Used the non-word skirmish, which is not a technical term, right? And rather than stating a punchline right away, Jon Stewart actually waits for 20 full seconds.
It's a long time. Yeah.
20 seconds. I mean, I'll just pause for 5 seconds now. I mean, that was excruciating.
I know.
Right?
It's dead air.
and imagine waiting 4 times that long with the audience is just ripped with laughter, and then finally he delivers a punchline, which isn't even a great punchline. He just says, nailed it, which is not even, you know, doesn't even have any substance, and people are just having this sort of gut-wrenching laughter because of delay. And I thought it was just such a great message for all of us in our daily communications, and the people who have to give speeches or negotiate. You know, a standard sales technique, if you're trying to sell someone, is you ask your closing question. If I could overcome all these objections, is there any reason you wouldn't buy from me right now? You ask that question, and then you wait as long as you possibly can. And experts in sales and negotiations always say that the person who speaks first is the one who will lose.
Yeah, the other thing that salespeople do that sort of makes me crazy is the whole, you know, when making a major purchase, if you decide right now, you get 20% off or something, which is sort of the sign for me to turn and run. But
it is a sign to turn and run, because usually what they're trying to get you to do is something that's not in your best interest.
Right.
They're trying to get you to do something quick, make a snap reaction that is not in your best interest, that you wouldn't do with reflection. And a lot of sales is coercing us to do things quickly that we wouldn't do if we took our time, which is a reason why people are often well-served to take a deep breath and have a cooling off period. It's why salespeople are so infuriated if you say, I'm sorry, but I have to wait for my wife. That's the one objection that a salesperson cannot overcome, or spouse or partner or, mm-hmm. or, you know, wait for someone else who has decision-making authority.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're often, again, this message of wait applies to all kinds of personal decisions where if we snap react, we'll end up buying something we don't need.
And it's interesting to go back to the Walker-Clark philosophy on panic that you mentioned, because any kind of delay, really, regardless of the situation, does require a sort of confidence in one's own ability to manage time.
I think that's exactly right. And it's amazing to watch great actors. And Walker runs these classes where he'll have a group of people come in and they'll play a game or do something where if you don't have confidence, you're likely to make a mistake or react too quickly or panic. And you can see on actors' faces when they're experiencing this. If you haven't been on camera or been, you know, on radio before, the first times that you do it, you experience panic and you rush, you speak too quickly, you say the wrong thing, then you try to climb out of it. And there is a kind of confidence that people get. And it's in all walks of life, right, that once we've done something for a while, we acquire a kind of comfort and confidence, and then we're willing to do it more slowly. We don't feel obligated to react instantaneously. We take our time. And that's really part of what leadership is, right, is that getting the experience and wisdom to be able to take a step back and not react right away.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Albert on the line in Cleburne. Hi, Albert.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hey, great show and always interesting. My question is regarding this waiting and how that affects in this particular time the media. And I'm specifically thinking of the Zimmerman case, the Trayvon Martin case, and it seems like everybody in that case on both sides are trying to get information out faster than the other. That it sounds like it's doing a lot of damage. Could you respond to that? And I'd like to take the answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Albert. It's a great question, and I think that case and others for the speed is a big problem in terms of getting accurate information. And one of the things that I think that I hope we all will keep in mind, especially I'm a law professor, right? So I think a lot about adversarial situations where you have two sides to the story, sometimes more than two sides, but at least two sides of the story being told, is that it's often not in our interest to get the quick versions of these stories from both sides. That what we're hearing is not objectively the truth. What we're hearing is each side's version of the truth, which may be biased, may be distorted. It might be right. But we have when the adversarial process works, when we get this kind of two-sided information coming in, it takes a long time, right? We go through a whole ordeal before a trial, and then we have a long trial, and we have jurors there, and we take our time, we introduce evidence, we have all these rules. But none of that applies in the 24-hour media cycle. So we just have this kind of crush of information coming in from both sides. And it's a problem because we don't know which side is credible. One side might be compelling but might be lying. We don't have the kinds of filters that we have in our justice system. And yet we're drawn to it, right? I mean, all of us love seeing the photographs and videos of crime scenes. We find it utterly compelling. But I think we'd all be better off taking it all with a dose of salt and taking a step back and understanding that the people who are communicating this information to us have they have a reason to want to spin the case one way or the other. It's a great question.
So another sort of mythological element of the human condition is the idea of love at first sight. But it turns out that we are better at deciding how we feel about somebody after we've given them a little time.
Yes, and this is especially important now that there's been a proliferation of online dating sites and meeting people just with photos on the web, because we snap react to photos, and photos are doctored or taken opportunistically anyway. But even if the photo is accurate, we snap react to the photos in ways that don't predict our ultimate happiness, that don't tell us we'll end up in a successful relationship. The things that matter for a successful relationship, things like chemistry and compatibility, you can't tell from a snap reaction to a photo, and you can't tell from a snap reaction to a person. I spent a lot of time with and interviewed the president of It's Just Lunch, the international dating network,
mm-hmm.
and their approach to this sort of problem is to have their clients take more time. They will not let their clients see photos of prospective dates as much as they want them, and we all want them. They simply say you can't have them because you'll snap react to them, and your snap reaction will be inaccurate. And then they tell them once they actually get on the first date, well, first of all, it's just lunch. Only do lunch. Don't do dinner. Don't do more than an hour or so. And then in the initial part of lunch, force yourself not to react. Force yourself to abstain from judgment. And then after lunch is over, at the very end of lunch, just ask yourself one simple question. Would you go out on a second date with this person? Don't extend it, but wait as long as you possibly can until the last minute and then make your judgment. And they found that that's a much more effective filtering device for people who want to find a long-term relationship, that it's much better than sifting through photos on the web, that we're all hardwired to react in certain ways that aren't necessarily going to predict a good, long-term, healthy relationship.
You know, I hear that story. It sounds like good advice for a lot of things that we do in life and a lot of decisions that we make. What it requires, though, is this investment of time, which we all feel we don't have enough of. And we end up squandering a lot of time worrying about how little we have.
Yes. And that's what modern life is like. We all are going to be the victim of this crush of technology. We're going to feel like we don't have enough time. We feel like we're working too many hours or more hours than our parents did, or than previous generations did, and so it's a challenge. This is not easy. But the message of weight and the message of the research I've gone through over the last 3 years is that we'll be happier and we'll be better off if we can find a way to pause, if we can find a way to take a step back from this kind of crush of technology and modern life. And try somehow, I know it's difficult, but try somehow to find those extra minutes or extra hours or extra days that will make better decisions and be happier if we can do that.
Do you have particular apprehension about digital natives and their relationship to time?
I'm sorry, digital?
Digital natives, the kids who have been born into the technology that you and I had to learn as young adults.
Oh, absolutely. I have two of them. I have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I worry all the time that they're snap reacting and that they won't have the ability to delay gratification that study after study shows is a predictor of future success. We think about it and talk about this all the time, and I try to help them choose for themselves. I mean, you can try to ban kids from exposure, but the reality is that they will be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And what the studies show is that for kids now that being able to delay gratification at a relatively young age is associated with success later in life. That the kids who can, instead of taking one marshmallow right away at the age of 4, if you can wait 15 minutes to get a second marshmallow, that you're going to have 150-point higher score on the SAT, that you're going to be less likely to be addicted to alcohol or drugs, you're going to have a happier marriage, and you're going to make more money. So I think it's a
crucial
question for our kids.
I hate to say it, Frank, we are out of time at this point. The new book by Frank Partnoy is called Wait, The Art and Science of Delay. Frank, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can find the podcast for free online at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.